Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, European and RCVS Veterinary Specialist in Small Animal Internal Medicine, Andrew Kent. Thank you, Andrew. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thanks very much indeed, and thanks to you guys for joining us and giving up some time over your lunch periods probably. I hope everybody's got a bit of the nice weather that we've got in the Midlands today. It's a bit of a treat to have it at this time of year, so I hope you're not stuck inside in a room without any windows listening to this. What we're going to talk about today is really a clinical approach really to urinary tract diseases. So it's a kind of tips and tricks type lecture, if you like, and then we'll talk about some specific cases and how those things that we've spoken about earlier on may then help us in our approach to some of the more tricky types of urinary tract disease. So a few things that we're going to kind of talk about really. We're going to look at how we think about localizing diseases within the urinary tract, and I think that's often quite critical in terms of then deciding exactly how we might approach the investigations. We're going to talk about what type of diagnostic testing might be appropriate and what we maybe should think about as we're analyzing those diagnostic tests. We're going to then think about some general approaches to therapy, and then, as I said before, some more specific kind of case examples where we can put some of the things that we've been speaking about into practice. So, as I mentioned before, I think one of the most important aspects of urinary tract disease, much like we do in other types of disease, you know, respiratory diseases or gut diseases, for example, is to try and think early on about where within the urinary tract we might localize the disease. Particularly, that's because it's very easy with urinary tract issues to use, I guess, diagnostic tests that are relatively focused on a specific area, maybe don't give us particularly good global overviews of the urinary tract, and we can end up, I guess, leading ourselves down the garden path sometimes by looking in the wrong place. So I guess most of the dogs that we think about with urinary tract disease are the kind of ones that present with lower urinary tract symptoms. So typical symptoms include the kind of dysuria, stranguria, you know, polaciuria, so the changes in the nature of the urination, sometimes the presence of hematuria, although, as you know, that can also be something that we see sometimes with upper urinary tract problems, sometimes incontinence, and you know, whilst that can most often is a urinary tract problem, obviously there can be causes of that outside the urinary tract as well, and often pain. Again, that can be a symptom that occurs with both of those things. Upper urinary tract problems, so kidney problems, for example, you know, more commonly presenting with so-called systemic symptoms, so PUPD, sometimes things such as vomiting. And then there's a big part of that upper urinary tract that actually can be quite challenging sometimes from a kind of clinical signs point of view. If we look at dogs and cats with ureteral diseases, such as ureteral obstructions, for example, those are often patients who present with very vague clinical symptoms that actually don't necessarily immediately make us think that the urinary tract may be the source of the problem. So they can be, you know, the abdominal pain, or in cats, because it's what cats like to do, you know, often just very vague lethargy, bit of a change in appetite, those kind of symptoms. So, you know, with those upper tract things, we're much more likely to see these kind of vague symptoms, for example. I think the signalment becomes a fairly important thing also from a urinary tract point of view. Obviously, there are certain diseases that are far more likely to occur in you know, certain types, breed, gender of patient. So the male versus female thing, particularly thinking about things like obstructive urolithiasis, you know, see that very commonly in male dogs, see that very uncommonly, we do see it from time to time, but very uncommonly in female dogs, for example. Breed is very important, again, particularly when it comes to things like urolithiasis and thinking about certain breeds that may be predisposed to specific types of urolithiasis. So, you know, the urate stones in the Dalmatians, for example, or some of our small breed. Sorry, I think you lost me for just a moment. I think my internet just cut out and then reconnected. So sorry if you lost me for just a moment. I was just saying about clinical examination side of things. I think it's important that we bear certain things in mind as we kind of look at these patients. So, firstly, from the point of view of the upper urinary tract, what do the kidneys feel like? Actually, you know, they're one of those areas that often we can palpate relatively easily in our patients. How big is the bladder? You know, if we're thinking about incontinent patients, for example, is this looking like an incontinent patient who has overflow of urine? You know, do they have a large bladder that is difficult to express, or are they more of a classical, you know, urethral localization of incontinence where we're seeing a small bladder, for example? If we do have a, you know, reasonably sized bladder, can we express that bladder? Again, if you're feeling a big bladder, you can't express it. We're more likely looking at obstructive disease versus, you know, kind of functional disease, if you like, if it's an easy thing to express, you know, a neurological cause of the bladder being enlarged, for example. Two areas that I think we very, very commonly miss out when we're examining patients where we're suspicious of urinary tract disease. The first being the conformation of the genitals, particularly in female dogs. I think we recognize increasingly that the impact of the conformation of the vulva can predispose some of these patients, particularly to infection, to urinary tract infection, for example. So, you know, is this a patient who has a very recessed vulva or so-called hooded vulva, where we might feel that we might get perivulval dermatitis and consequently increase our infection risk? And in both male and female dogs, it's worth doing a rectal examination. We're all, you know, fairly used to doing rectal examinations in male dogs from the point of view of prostatic disease. But actually, in female dogs, I find that a useful thing in terms of examination of that pelvic portion of the urethra, particularly dogs who present with urethral tumors, for example. If we're seeing dysuric patients, many of those have a very palpably abnormal urethra when we perform a rectal examination. You know, it feels like a kind of thickened sausage, where, you know, really we don't normally feel the kind of normal urethra. So not something that we instinctively think about doing, but I think that it is a useful thing for us to do to perform rectal examinations in that way. We've mentioned the vulval conformation side of things, and these are the kind of extremes. You know, these are the kind of patients that we might see with recurrent urinary tract infection. Often we get fixated on the, you know, the type of bugs and repeatedly culturing bacteria and things like that. Actually, I think if you see a patient like this, it's probably no surprise that they might get episodes of urinary tract infection because we've got a perfect perivulval environment for bacteria. Particularly, many of these dogs, I think, will have a degree of subclinical incontinence as well, and that obviously can make that whole situation an awful lot worse. So, the reason that our localization is so crucial is for exactly this reason, that I think our approach to the investigation is going to diverge based on the things that we might see or do. So, while some things have some common ground, you know, we're typically performing urine analysis, for example, in patients with both upper and lower urinary tract disease. The type of other investigation that we perform may differ. So, for example, in upper urinary tract or kidney diseases, we're much more likely to find, you know, blood work abnormalities that are useful for us to know about. In lower urinary tract disease, actually, blood work is often not a particularly helpful thing to do. Both of our patients are likely to benefit from some form of imaging. In the lower urinary tract, actually, we need to remember that there's a big portion of that urinary tract, so the urethra in most dogs, that is within an area that we can't really see with most of our kind of conventional imaging techniques. You know, ultrasound doesn't tell us really anything about urethral disease. So we may be more likely to combine things like ultrasound and cystoscopy or contrast studies of the lower urinary tract. With the upper urinary tract, you know, that imaging, particularly ultrasound, is likely to be key in terms of affecting a diagnosis. So we're going to think about those things in slightly different ways, and we'll talk about them each in turn. I think urine analysis is one of those areas that it's very easy to, again, I guess, get kind of drawn down the garden path in terms of getting fixated on problems that may not necessarily be problems. And so I think there's certain little tips that's worth bearing in mind when it comes to interpreting analysis of urine. We all routinely perform urine-specific gravity very cheap and helpful test for us to do, but we should understand its limitations. About the only time that I think running a single urine-specific gravity on a patient is useful is when we're looking at an azotemic patient and we want to determine if that azotemia is pre-renal or renal. Can they concentrate their urine, or are they dehydrated, for example? If we're looking at any other kind of cause of the urine-specific gravity being abnormal, we really need to look at that on multiple samples. We know that in dogs they can vary enormously through the day, and actually it is quite normal for some of them to have quite dilute urine at certain times of day, particularly dogs who have certain types of lifestyle or during different environmental conditions, for example. So if you have a patient who is polyuric, polydipsic, and maybe you didn't see much on your blood work, and you do a urine specific gravity, I think it's much more useful to try and run multiple urine specific gravities throughout a 12, 24-hour period, so that we can see what does this patient's urine specific gravity do? Is this a dog who can ever concentrate its urine, or is this a dog who always has very, very dilute urine? And I think that gives us a much better picture of the dog's concentrating ability. The first sample of the morning, typically the one that we think about as potentially being most concentrated, because I guess most dogs drink the least overnight, but not always. So, as I say, I think looking at that over a day is a helpful thing to do. Urine pH, again, it's easy to get carried away, I think, looking at pH in urine samples. And I think there's actually relatively few situations where we get particularly concerned about what the pH is doing of urine. The one thing I would say that is useful is pH is best to interpret in fasted samples. We know that we get these postprandial surges in pH, which can impact that. And so if we want to get a view of what the urine pH genuinely is, it's useful to do that on a fasted sample. Presence of protein, again, useful thing for us to do in many of our patients, particularly our chronic kidney disease patients, in terms of knowing whether we need to be treating those dogs differently with, ACE inhibitors or telmisartan, for example. I guess the important thing with protein is that it is best assessed through running a urine protein creatinine ratio, so a UPC, rather than just relying on urine dipsticks. Presence of blood, again, can be a useful indicator for disease within the urinary tract. We use that regularly if we're monitoring dogs for recurrence of urolithiasis and many other reasons as well. But remember that obviously other pigments within the urine can sometimes interfere with the analysis of blood, particularly on a urine dipstick. So your sediment analysis, looking at whether we're actually seeing red blood cells, is a useful part of that. Urine crystals, I think, is in some ways a lecture in its own right, because we see lots of patients where we pick up crystals within their urine, and sometimes I think those can be very difficult things to interpret. I suppose the take-home messages when it comes to crystals is that, number one, we really need to analyze those samples instantly. We should be analyzing samples when they are still at body temperature in order to get a meaningful evaluation of whether those crystals are present within the dog. As soon as the temperature of the urine changes, we start to see precipitation of crystals, and those are obviously not things that are present within that dog and therefore likely to be clinically insignificant. So these should not be samples that the owner's taken at home and kept in the fridge overnight. These should ideally be samples that are collected, at the surgery. If needed, send the owner out into the car park with a dish. But really, we want to be looking at those straight away. They're also not things that we can be sending to the outside lab. It's not useful to see whether the outside lab finds crystals when they get the sample several hours or days after it's been collected. The other thing to bear in mind with crystals is that the presence of crystals is not a disease. And sometimes, again, I think we can get carried away trying to treat things like the presence of crystals when, yes, they may be a risk factor for disease, such as the presence of urolithiasis. Yes, they may be an indicator sometimes of disease, such as struvite crystals being an indicator of infection. But, they are rarely a problem in their own right. All of these things, I think, can be helped further by thinking about a sediment evaluation. And all of our patients, I say, I think, should probably have a sediment evaluation as part of our urine analysis that we're performing, it allows us to, as we've mentioned before, to look at things like our red blood cells, seeing whether those are genuinely present, and also allows us to pick up the presence of things like bacteria, for example. So we might be able to determine earlier on whether these are samples that are useful for us to culture, whether these are samples where we ought to be, starting the patient on a specific treatment before we, get the result of more extended analysis back. Bacterial culture is also a challenging thing. We know that we can see very commonly false negative results in bacterial cultures, particularly when we're submitting these to the external lab. A lot of the time the nature of urine is such that bacteria end up dying on the way to the lab. So we can see patients where we're very suspicious of infection, but we can't document that through positive cultures. I think in those patients, sometimes we will look at culturing a spun down sediment. So sometimes, if I'm very suspicious of infection, I'll spin down some urine in a tube. I'll discard, most of the liquid component, and I'll put a swab in the sediment, and submit a charcoal swab of that sample, which, sometimes will grow positive results when just a culture of the urine is negative. So we touched on the fact that blood work can be a helpful thing to do. Primarily, I guess we're thinking about that in our upper urinary tract problems, where we're thinking about evaluation of what the kidneys might be doing. Sometimes it can be helpful in other settings as well, such as, the presence of inflammation, the presence of hypercalcemia, which is important if we're seeing patients with, potentially calcium oxalate stones. And then sometimes coagulation assessments. Again, if we're seeing hematuric patients, sometimes that can occur as part of, being thrombocytopenic, for example, although, again, typically we would expect other symptoms at that time. So I suppose for all of us, ultrasound has become a fairly routine test for us to be performing in patients where we're suspicious of urinary tract disease, and it allows us to evaluate a reasonable number of important structures in the urinary tract. So I think it is particularly helpful for evaluation of the kidneys, potentially looking at the ureters, particularly if they're abnormal. The bladder, relatively straightforward thing for us to be ultrasounding. Often the prostate in male dogs, and then maybe things like the local lymph nodes if we are worried about near plastic disease, for example. So ultrasound of the kidneys is probably something many of us do fairly routinely, and there's lots of changes that can be strongly indicative of certain types of disease state. We can see more chronic changes, for example. We can see more acute changes, for example. So these are both patients that have ureteral obstructions, and we're seeing evidence of significant renal pelvic dilation. And in a dog like this, this is occurring because you see this shadowing stone sitting in the proximal part of the ureter and causing this really nice dilation of the pelvis of the kidney. So something like that on ultrasound is, diagnostic for a ureteral obstruction and can help us a lot. A lot of the time, the changes that we're seeing might be, more subtle things, changes in the architecture of the kidneys that might fit with chronic kidney disease, for example. The bladder as well, here's a couple of dogs who probably have cystitis type symptoms, for example, and you can see this incredible turbid urine sitting in the bladder of this dog with very marked thickening of the wall of the bladder. Similar, this is going to be a patient with probably chronic lower urinary tract signs where we're seeing a relatively thickened wall to the bladder. There are some tips from the point of view of trying to maximize the amount of information that we achieve from ultrasound of the bladder. Number one being that ideally we need the bladder to be reasonably full for ultrasound to be useful. If you have a very small bladder, then sometimes we can artifactually think that the wall is very thickened when it may not be. Number two, it's useful to, obviously think about if we are suspicious about diseases that we might see in other forms of imaging, such as uroliths, for example. Sometimes, plain radiographs can give us some idea in advance as to what we might see. If you need to change, obviously, the how full or empty the bladder is, sometimes we will instill saline into the bladder so that it's distended enough for us to have a good look at what may be going on. But say occasionally we see patients who, are overdiagnosed with conditions on the basis of having a very empty bladder at the time that ultrasound is performed. That is also a challenge, I think, if you're a patient who has, cystitis type symptoms, or you have urinary incontinence, for example, because many of those patients have very empty bladders for much of the time. So what about radiographs in urinary tract disease? As I've mentioned before, I think that plain radiographs are particularly useful if we're thinking about stone disease, although, as we know, there are some stones that we're not going to see very well radiographically. So it's most useful in our struvite-forming dogs or our calcium oxalate-forming dogs, where hopefully those stones are going to be very obvious and very visible when we look at them on an X-ray. Also important if we're thinking about patients who potentially have neoplastic disease as a kind of screening tool for metastatic disease. And occasionally we can see things such as involvement of the lumbar spine in dogs with prostatic neoplasia, for example, that might give us an idea based on plain radiographs. Contrast radiographs are something that have been performed for many years in patients with urinary tract disease, and I think that they do still have a role in some patients. But I suppose they have been superseded to some degree by some of the other techniques that we have, such as cystoscopy, for example. And we definitely perform significantly less contrast radiographs than we might have done previously. I think that the primary time that contrast radiographs are still helpful are evaluation of urethral disease where cystoscopy is not available or not possible. We still perform a lot of contrast radiographs in male dogs with urethral obstruction, many of those on their way into surgery, for example, to have those stones removed. But we do it very infrequently in patients with suspected, say, neoplasia of their urethra, where I think that looking at those patients with cystoscopy, where we can also collect samples, is a more helpful thing for us to do. Contrast studies can also be helpful for evaluation of the ureters, particularly these are more systemic contrast studies, so IVUs or CT-IVU, for example. I guess we need to be aware of the limitations of using contrast studies for that purpose. If you do have ureteral obstructions, often the kidneys filter contrast very poorly, and consequently, we will get poor filling of the ureters. It can still be a helpful technique if we're thinking about ectopic ureters, for example, although, there are other techniques that have much higher sensitivity and are much easier to interpret than contrast radiographs. So let's have a look at some examples. No prizes for this one. Really nice present urolithes sitting in the dependent part of the bladder. Those are the kind of dogs that we can see an issue very quickly. This is also a dog that has a urethral stone. If you look just in the behind its stifle, let me find a little pointer here. There's also a little urethral stone probably in this dog as well. But say if your stones appear easily on radiographs, you can't beat a radiograph really for that diagnosis. Contrast radiographs. So this is a patient with an ectopic ureter, and when ectopic ureters show up nicely on contrast studies, they are, nice things to diagnose. We see our ureter coming down; it's dilated, which already suggests to us that may be a diseased ureter. And we see that it travels down. We're in the urethra here, and we're seeing this, what is likely to be a thin membrane sitting between the ureter and the urethra, so consistent with an intramural ectopic ureter. This is in a retrograde vaginal urethrogram. The challenge with these patients is that they very rarely look like this. A lot of the time when we're performing contrast studies, we get a lot of superimposition of different structures within the abdomen, and they are very rarely as clear-cut as this patient might be. There's a reason that this is a relatively old radiograph, because, as I said before, they never look quite as clear-cut as this these days. Dogs with urethral obstruction. So this may be a patient with a tumor or a stricture of the urethra. And we can demonstrate that very nicely on contrast radiographs. But those are, relatively uncommon diseases. And as I said before, often if we're looking at those with a cystoscope, for example, it would also allow us to be taking biopsies of those things. So in a single procedure, we may be able to achieve a little bit more than doing all of these contrast radiographs. There are some conditions that it would be almost impossible to diagnose with any other techniques. So this is a relatively uncommon case, but this is a dog with a uretrovaginal fistula. So we see that the ureter comes down nicely, but actually it's attaching onto the vagina. Sometimes we can see these spontaneously. Sometimes we can see these forming in patients who have a ureteral obstruction because of ligation at the time of a spay. And sometimes when that ureter kind of recanalates itself, it will end up connecting to the vagina rather than where it ought to be connecting. These are the kind of patients who have, very challenging disease and probably wouldn't be diagnosed in any way other than with contrast studies. So certainly they have their place in these kind of dogs. And sometimes if these, challenging incontinence patients or these challenging urinary tract infection patients, we will still consider performing them alongside some of our other techniques. But, be aware definitely of the limitations of these things. We can improve the sensitivity of picking things up with contrast by doing that using CT. It becomes a more complex or more expensive imaging modality to employ. But as I mentioned before, one of the challenges that we see in dogs with contrast studies is that kind of superimposition of different structures. And so, if we can overcome that with a three-dimensional imaging modality, we can potentially improve the sensitivity. So, this is a male dog with an ectopic ureter. We still, perform a reasonable number of CT IVUs on male dogs for this reason. And this little bit here is the distal part of the ureter. So, the ureter ought to be inserting, around here. Instead, we're seeing contrast filling into the proximal part of the urethra. So consistent with diagnosis of an ectopic ureter. And in male dogs, CTIVUs are probably our best test for diagnosing this disease. They probably are more sensitive even than cystoscopy because of the limitations of cystoscopy in male patients. So I think CT is helpful in that kind of setting really. We may have been able to see those things with other imaging modalities, but we're likely to be more confident in the diagnosis, I suppose, if we're seeing that in this way. So, what about cystoscopy? Well, certainly we've spoken about the imaging modalities that we're primarily using to evaluate the abdominal part of the urinary tract. And there is this big chunk, particularly the urethral component, where we really don't evaluate that very well with our ultrasound, for example. So in any patient who has lower urinary tract symptoms and does not have an obvious cause, when we look at the bladder with ultrasound, we need to do something alongside that to evaluate the urethra. That could be our contrast studies that we've just been talking about, but if you have access to it, cystoscopy is often more sensitive for picking up disease in those areas. And many of us actually have the facilities in the practice to perform cystoscopy. There's lots of practices these days who are going into laparoscopy, lap spays, keyhole surgeries, for example. That means that you've got a lot of the equipment on the shelf that you might need to be able to perform this. And so it's probably something that more of us could be doing to, again, get more confident diagnoses in these patients. It allows us to evaluate, the bladder, which we've already looked at with other methods, but potentially take samples, for example. It allows us to get probably our best view of the urethra. We can look at the location of the urethrovesicular junctions, which is, really going to be our test of choice to evaluate those young incontinent patients for potential ectopic ureters. And it allows us to evaluate the other bits of the urinary tract or the reproductive tract, particularly in female patients. It is also possible, depending on your size and your conformation, potentially to perform endoscopy into the ureters and even the renal pelvis in dogs of a reasonable size. And so those techniques are in their infancy, but they are possible. As I mentioned before, many of us have the equipment already that we might need for these. So some form of rigid endoscope. Most of us use a 2.6 millimeter endoscope, but if you've got something close to that, then you may have something that would work for this purpose. Most of us use some form of kind of ability to connect that to a camera. It's a little bit challenging to perform cystoscopy without a camera. So if you do have access to a again the camera that you might use for laparoscopy, you can use that for cystoscopy as well. And then often some form of biopsy forceps or grasp, but depending on what it is that we're wanting to be doing at that time. And we simply connect up our scope as we would be useful to doing so, and we attach a bag of warmed fluid, usually in a pressure bag, so we get some pressure behind that fluid, because most cystoscopy is performed under relatively constant irrigation of fluid, so that we're distending the tissues away from the end of the endoscope. Patient positioning is something of a matter of personal preference. I tend to perform all of my cystoscopies in dorsal recumbency because then, I find it much easier to determine which side the different uretrovesicular junctions are. It's also the position that we use for many of our urinary interventions because of the fact that we're also often using fluoroscopy to guide those things. But I know many other people perform cystoscopy in lateral recumbency, for example. And we tend to try and make this as clean, never going to be a sterile process, but certainly as clean as possible. So we tend to clip around the vulva and perform a basic surgical prep around of those areas. It is possible to perform rigid cystoscopy in male dogs as well. This dog at the bottom here is a dog who's having something called perineal access performed. So it's where we puncture a little hole into the perineal urethra, which allows us to put our rigid scope in there, and it just seals up again afterwards. So, male dogs where we want the higher image quality that a rigid scope gives us over a flexible scope, we may use that technique. A bit more invasive, obviously, than in female dogs, but it is an achievable thing to do. And cystoscopy gives us these beautiful images of the urinary tract because of the fact we are, on the whole, looking through, glass telescopes for these. They're very, very high quality images. They're much better than we even see with some of the flexible endoscopes that we use in the gut or in the respiratory tract, for example. So on the left, a normal appearance of the vaginal opening at the top, the urethral opening at the bottom. So vagina up here, urethra at the bottom, and a normal appearance to the urethra on the right here. We mentioned before that we're often trying to evaluate the uretrovesicular junctions. So these are the two normal UVJs that we can see in a dog. This is what it might look like if things were abnormal. So this is a dog with an ectopic ureter who, as we're looking up through the urethra, has two openings rather than one. Couple of things then that we might see. This is actually a normal variation that if you perform endoscopy in entire female dogs, you often see a very prominent protuberance just beneath the urethral opening. That's not pathological. People are sometimes minded to try and biopsy those things, but actually that's normal in entire female dogs. Over on the right-hand side, typical of appearance of a transitional cell carcinoma. So this is going to be a dog with a bladder or a urethral TCC. They can come in all shapes and sizes. We can see dogs with more kind of polypoid type lesions. We can see some dogs with more diffuse thickening, but probably this is the most common appearance of those things, these kind of multiple frond-like projections. On the left here, this was a dog who was having hemorrhagic vaginal discharge, and this was a nice polyp that was sitting within the vagina, which often can be removed using endoscopy, for example, to resolve that problem. And on the right-hand side, this is a pretty typical appearance of the vestibule in a dog who maybe has chronic lower urinary tract disease, particularly chronic incontinence, for example. We often see these little lymphoid follicles that become hyperplastic within the vestibule. So if you're a dog with juvenile vaginitis or, as I say, chronic incontinence, often we'll see these things when we're looking. So we'll have a look at how this appears then in real time. Hopefully this will all work okay. As Sammy Joe said before, you can make this full screen if you want to see it a bit more clearly, but I'll show you how quickly cystoscopy is able to kind of show whether things are normal or abnormal, for example. So as I mentioned before, we're performing this under relatively constant irrigation of fluid that allows all of this tissue to distend away from the end of the endoscope. And from the view we had at the beginning there, which is, was looking at both the urethral and the vaginal openings, we're now advancing the endoscope down through the urethra. One thing that's a little bit different with cystoscopy is that generally we use a 30-degree endoscope, which means it's looking, at a 30-degree angle away from the end of the endoscope. It allows us to take a slightly broader field of view than we might do otherwise. We've found our way here to the end of the urethra. We've probably just skipped out the bit where we would empty all of the urine out of the bladder. and then fill the bladder back up with that warmed saline so that we get a clearer view. A lot of these patients have relatively turbid urine. We're looking there at one uretrovesicular junction, so that's going to be the dog's left. And then we swing over to where we should there see the other uretrovesicular junction. So both of those sitting in exactly the location and with exactly the appearance that we would expect them to have. So if we're wanting to look at this in a young dog, this may be a young incontinent patient, is this a dog with ectopic ureters? We've ruled those out within, about 30 seconds of starting our procedure, rather than having to pain over those contrast radiographs that we might be looking at otherwise. We can have a good look around the bladder, and sometimes it helps for us to fill or empty the bladder. Obviously, the fuller the bladder is, the more the far wall of the bladder will move away from the end of your endoscope. So by emptying the bladder, the wall comes towards you, and sometimes we can then take biopsy samples of the bladder wall or obviously evaluate any lesions further. And then we tend to make a careful evaluation of the urethra. As I was mentioning before, that 30-degree view of the endoscope means that what is actually in front of you is not quite in front of you, if that makes sense. And so we have to be careful that we don't cause too much trauma to the urinary tract by misunderstanding use of a 30-degree endoscope. And we tend to withdraw the endoscope then slowly through the urethra so that we can pick up any more subtle lesions that might appear. And then in a female dog, once we've evaluated the urethra side of things, we would typically then second, go and evaluate the vagina. We usually do that second because it is likely to be a less sterile part of the urinary tract. Not that we really believe that the urinary tract is a sterile area anymore, like we may have done in years gone by. But we always evaluate the kind of bladder urethra aspect first before we move on to having a look then at the vagina. Again, we can use that irrigation of fluid to hold our endoscope, and we can gradually retract our endoscope. So we tend to advance as far in as we can, and then gradually retract that endoscope as we're irrigating that fluid to pick up any more subtle lesions. Relatively, we see very few patients with vaginal disease compared to the patients that we're usually evaluating for urethral or bladder disease. As we showed the still image of before, we're looking around the vestibule to see if there is any of these lymphoid follicles that look particularly hyperplastic. Nothing obvious in this patient. And we can then swing our endoscope up and have a look within the clitoral fossa as well, which can be a useful area to evaluate in some dogs also. So you can see there that within, kind of 4 minutes, we've been able to reasonably well evaluate that lower urinary tract, and the image quality is such that is by far the highest sensitivity for picking up things like ectopic ureters, for example. We're going to pick up all of our urethral tumors much more easily than relying on contrast radiographs. So, I think it's a useful technique for us to be performing. So, in most of our patients, if we've performed some form of imaging, looking at the abdominal component, and then hopefully done something like a cystoscopy to look at the lower part of the urinary tract, we're going to have a pretty good idea of what may be going on from a disease point of view. And I think that whenever we approach dogs who have urinary tract disease, we really need to think about two aspects of that disease. There's often the disease itself or the underlying issue, and many of the times actually the things that we see, the things that causes clinical symptoms, is more the complication of that disease. So actually many of our patients may have underlying anatomical diseases or systemic diseases or kind of functional abnormalities, so urethral sphincter mechanism incompetence, for example. And those things then in turn predispose those patients to things that cause more obvious symptoms, so infection, tissue proliferation, further functional abnormalities, or presence of urolith, for example. And so we tend to have to take an overview of both of those areas when we start thinking about how we treat dogs with urinary tract disease. And if we just address one of those, there is clearly then a risk that we end up in a situation where we've kind of overlooked the underlying problem, and consequently, we end up in a circle of where things continue to go on. So we'll have a look at some example cases to see how we might apply some of these things then to the type of patients that we might see. So here's a typical dog that I suppose might come to see us. These are young incontinent patients. So often they may be golden retrievers. Some of them will be French bulldogs, things like that. But really we see all breeds presenting in this way. And many of these patients have relatively long history of being incontinent. Often people don't pick up on that until later because they think these are just patients who are challenging from the point of view of toilet training, for example. But actually, they may be patients who have more of an underlying issue for that. This is a patient who has, unremarkable urine analysis, but did have an ultrasound change that was suspicious that maybe it had an ectopic ureter. So it gives us a good opportunity to talk about incontinence. I'm sure you see huge numbers of incontinent patients. We certainly see lots of incontinent dogs, and they can be challenging dogs to get to the bottom of sometimes. There's a good proportion of them who respond very well and very completely to medical treatment, but there's a tricky, few percent who really can leave us scratching our heads sometimes. So, we spoke earlier on about how we localize urinary tract disease in general, and I think incontinence is a particularly important aspect where localization is important. Because if we localize incontinence incorrectly, we can end up in a situation where we're treating a completely incorrect disease. And obviously, in that setting, we're not really going to expect those patients to respond to the medication that we might be using. So, in my mind, I tend to divide those patients into these two groups, really. These are incontinence patients without distended bladders or incontinent patients with distended bladders. Now, if you don't have bladder distension, that's going to be most of our incontinence. And those are going to be dogs who essentially their incontinence localizes to their urethra. That's the bit that's not working properly. Most commonly, that's the older dogs who get urethral sphincter mechanism incompetence, USMI. But we can see it in other things as well. Urge incontinence, which maybe can occur associated with infection, can look similar. I'm not a great believer that infection alone can cause incontinence, but perhaps it can contribute to the symptoms sometimes. That is also the type of incontinence that often will be made worse if you have polyuric, polydipsic patients. If you're getting bigger volumes of dilute urine, you're putting a bigger strain on the tone of your urethra to try and retain that urine within the urinary tract. So we can make it worse with that problem. If we're seeing dogs with large bladders, those are very atypical for dogs with urethral sphincter mechanism incompetence. And so we need to think much more about whether there's an underlying issue in those patients. The most common cause that we would see for those is patients who've had obstruction, and develop some degree of detrusor dysfunction as a result of that. But we can sometimes see it in some of our neurological patients as well. And then there are some more uncommon diseases that can look very similar to those things. So in our non-distended bladder group, that's where we might see some of our more unusual things, such as the ectopic ureters. We see a reasonable number of those, but I appreciate they are an uncommon diagnosis overall. Some of the other congenital or anatomical abnormalities within the urinary tract. And then in our patients with big distended bladders, again, that's where we see maybe some of our more unusual neurological causes, or some of our difficult to diagnose urethral obstruction patients, so urolithiasis, for example. Reflex dyssynergia is an important diagnosis, I think, to mention in that that category. These are usually male dogs who present with signs that look like an obstruction, but we can't find a physical obstruction in those patients. And they can, get this reflex dyssynergia where we feel that the urethra doesn't relax appropriately as the bladder tries to contract. And often what we see then is overflow incontinence in those dogs. So this is going to be a typical cystoscopic appearance of how our, young incontinent patient may look. In this case, gives us no surprise that this is a dog with an ectopic ureter. And similar to the image you saw earlier, when we look into the urethra, we tend to see this dividing band of tissue sitting within the central part of the urethra. So we've got normal urethra at the top, we've got a uretral opening at the bottom, and that's diagnostic for an intramural ectopic ureter. The image on the right is a persistent membrane, and we often see persistent membranes, or otherwise known as vestibulovaginal septal remnants, that sit often, just beneath the urethral opening. And it's very common to see those in dogs with ectopic ureters. So if we look into the vestibule and we see some tissue sitting in that region, it makes it much more likely for us to see that diagnosis. And they can come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. Sometimes these can be very, very chunky, thick bands of tissue to the point that they can almost divide the whole of the vagina in half. In some patients, they can be very fragile little strands of tissue, like in this dog. And the nice thing with cystoscopy in young incontinent patients is that it also potentially then allows us to treat those things. So most of our ectopic ureter patients these days would be treated with a cystoscopic laser ablation, which is where we put a catheter, so this little orange catheter, into the ureter. This is going to be our bladder or a urethral opening up here, and we use this laser fiber to burn away this tissue that shouldn't be there between the urethra and the ureter, and that has, very good success at resolving that aspect of the disease. Some of them can still have some degree of urinary incontinence, but more because often, concurrent USMI can be present in around a third of patients that are treated. I'm sure that many of you are very familiar with the medical treatment options for urinary incontinence, and it is very effective. We know that in most of our dogs, use of a single drug, be that phenylpropanolamine, be that estriol, so propylene or other brands do exist, or Incurin, for example. If we use either of those drugs alone, we're getting a good proportion of dogs, 70, 75%, who will respond. Combining those drugs together pushes that number up even further, up to 90% of dogs that will respond. So, most of our, USMI patients will respond to one or a combination of those things. When those fail, there are some other drugs that we will sometimes use. We don't use a lot of ephedrine, but it is reported in male dogs, particularly male neutered dogs, and male dogs with USMI are uncommon, and they are typically very challenging. But one medical treatment option we will sometimes consider is testosterone, and that can be helpful in some of those patients, particularly if they haven't responded to phenylpropanolamine, for example. When medical management fails, or if medical management doesn't work, then there's a variety of surgical treatment options described, including things such as colposuspension, submucosal injection of bulking agents, or some of these more recent techniques, such as placement of a hydraulic cuff, which is a little cuff that goes around the urethra and can be inflated over time because of a little port that sits underneath the skin. And, depending on which surgeon you speak to, they will tell you that each of these are more or less effective in their hands, and often that comes down to a matter of personal preference as to which of those things might be used. But certainly we sometimes will consider those in patients who are not doing well otherwise. When do we think about that? Well, particularly, as we've mentioned, if medical management has failed, or if you see patients who have significant adverse effects on medical management. Some of those drugs can cause behavioral changes, excitement, hypertension, things like that. And so, if we're struggling with those medical treatments, we may be much more likely to reach for one of these things. Sometimes in young individuals, some people advocate these as a treatment option earlier on. Is it better to undergo a surgery and potentially be able to avoid lifelong medical therapy? Potentially. There are some things that we try and avoid. We try to let have dogs have a few seasons, at least one season, because some of them will improve with a season. We try to avoid it if there is significant obesity, for example. We know that can, make those symptoms worse. And, I think surgery needs to be carefully considered in terms of the investigations that have been performed. Again, we don't want to perform a colposuspension in a dog that has an ectopic ureter. We're unlikely to help it very much. So hopefully that gives us a bit of a rundown of incontinence. The second an area of urinary tract disease that we'll have a bit of a chat about is more than the infection side of things, I suppose. So we'll talk about Bella, who was a dog that I saw probably a year or two ago now, who had the typical history that we might expect in some of these dogs who have chronic infectious problems. So it's a young, young dog. Female neutered Jack Russell had this history of lower urinary tract disease. He had loads of courses of antibiotic, and often would get a bit better when it had antibiotics, but often would get worse again afterwards. He was being treated with a urinary diet. And actually, when I first saw this dog, it was really quite unwell. It had significant kind of abdominal pain. It was very sensitive around the lower part of its abdomen, and was really just not itself. Now, if you look at the kind of blood work that we might see in a patient like this, I guess the most notable thing is we're seeing a significant neutrophilia. We're seeing changes on our blood work that ultimately says to us, this may well be a patient who has an infectious or an inflammatory condition going on. And when we look at the urine, we kind of say, well, it's reasonably well concentrated. It is a little bit more alkaline than we might expect, and we'll interpret that in the context of everything else that's going on. We see some blood, we see some protein, and this is a dog who has pyuria, and it's a very inflammatory urine, and there is the presence of struvite crystals, which, as we spoke about, on their own, don't really tell us very much, but they can be an indicator of disease. And the most common thing that they're going to indicate in our patients is potentially the presence of infection. But from a challenging point of view, we have a negative bacterial growth in this dog. So we're looking at the urine analysis and saying, this looks like a patient who has infection, but we don't manage to culture that infection. Other things then we did with this patient, we ultrasounded its bladder. I showed this picture early on, and this is, a dog who has a very unpleasant looking bladder. It's a very, very thickened wall to the bladder, and it has the incredible, very echogenic, dense material sitting within the urinary bladder. If we look at that with cystoscopy, what we could see is these huge chunks of debris really within the bladder. These were not stones per se, they were just very frond-like chunks of material. Here's some more images of it. So we could just see these kind of plaques of material sitting within the bladder. It was honestly one of the most unpleasant bladders that I think I've ever seen. And where you would touch the wall, the bladder wall would bleed very easily. It was clearly a very unpleasant situation that was going on within the bladder. And if we analyze some of this debris, so we grabbed some out and we sent it to be analyzed, we saw that this was 70% struvite, 30% calcium phosphate carbonate, both of which are infection-related items. So both struvite and the calcium phosphate carbonate are infection-induced debris. So again, we've got a further piece of evidence in a dog like this that it likely has chronic infection. But we really can't prove that from the tests that we're doing. Why might that be the case? Well, it's possible that this is just one of those situations where we're going to find something that is difficult for us to culture. We know because of the fact that this dog had primarily struvite that it's likely that if there is bacteria there, they're going to be a urease-producing bug. They're the ones that are going to be associated with the presence of struvite. The types of bug that we might see, things like staph, proteus, well, those are things that usually we would be able to culture from a urine sample. So then we think about some of the more unusual bugs, and we start thinking then about infections such as ureaplasma, which is very difficult to culture, infections such as Carinobacterium, that also is very, very difficult for the lab to culture. And so it's very common in those kind of infections that we can see suggestion of infection without being able to pick those things up. And so, in a dog like this, we can talk to our lab about whether we can do more prolonged cultures. Sometimes we can pick up things like ureaplasma with selective forms of culture with Carinobacterium. We can sometimes pick those up with more prolonged cultures, for example. And those are all definitely things for us to talk to our lab about. Or sometimes we will presumptively treat and look at some of the antibiotics, for example, that we know may be more likely to be effective against things like ureaplasma, so doxycycline, for example. And in this dog, we put it on doxycycline for a month, and actually, very, very quickly, its symptoms resolved. So I guess I'm suspicious that that may have been ureaplasma infection. Sometimes, particularly with those crusts of material, that's more commonly associated with Carinobacterium, and that can be a very challenging infection sometimes to address, often becomes multi-resistant, and because it's difficult for us to culture, it's difficult for us to determine, which antimicrobials may be the best ones to use. But, in this occasion, we got lucky and managed to improve the situation significantly. And this is a dog who went from having a long period of time of being unwell to having resolution of those symptoms. So what about in these dogs where we know they get recurrent infections or chronic infections, and we really can't stop those things from happening? I'm sure you have patients like this. They're some of the patients that I despair about the most, because they're the dogs that we treat them with antibiotics, they get better, and as soon as they're off antibiotics, they get worse again. So what should we kind of consider in these patients in terms of strategies for dealing with these chronic infection patients? Should we be looking at more antibiotics or different methods of treating with antibiotics? So some people advocate very prolonged courses. Not sure that we're really helping those dogs with very prolonged courses. We just cause more of an upset to their, vaginal and gut flora. Should we use things like pulse antibiotic treatment? Well, again, I'm not a huge fan of anything that requires regular use of antibiotics. It does happen sometimes. There are things that sometimes don't, can't be treated in any other way, but certainly it's something that we try to avoid. What about the urinary antiseptics? Well, certainly these are things that I would try in some of these dogs. So drugs such as methenamine and methionine, so urinary acidifiers alongside urinary antiseptics, and that can help in some patients, although some dogs are intolerant of those medications. Sometimes we think about topical therapies, particularly in male dogs. We'll use forms of EDTA, so tetra-EDTA or tris-EDTA to flush the bladder. Sometimes we use very dilute chlorhexidine to flush the bladder. Gives us a potential, non-antibiotic method of addressing disease. Should we be using things like probiotics or even things like fecal transplantation? Well, I think that that is an area that really is in its infancy. I suspect that some of these dogs, these things are a manifestation of, an upset, either vaginal or more generalized microbiota. And actually, there may be strategies that can help to try and address that. Should we use things like the proanthocyanins, the cranberry extracts, for example? We don't have particularly compelling evidence in our patients that they're helpful, but they probably do no harm. And what about consideration then of some of those underlying causes? Some of the things we're going to find quite quickly. We all know that maybe diabetic patients are going to be predisposed to infection. Some of the things are more challenging to determine, such as the presence of subclinical incontinence or anatomical predispositions. And we touched about some of the vulval issues earlier on. I will sometimes trial some of these dogs on medical treatments for incontinence if nothing else seems to work. And if we do pick up an anatomical abnormality, then sometimes those are things that we can address with surgery. So, treatment of the hooded vulva may resolve predisposition to infection in some patients. And then just in the last few minutes, we'll talk about, the kind of one of the other areas of the urinary tract that I guess causes us relatively common concerns. This was again a dog that we saw a year or two ago, a dog called Ralphie, who came with relatively vague symptoms, lethargy, vomiting, and pyrexia. And he was referred primarily because his vets were worried that his kidneys looked a bit abnormal on ultrasound. We did some investigations. His blood work was pretty unremarkable. His analysis of his urine really was pretty suggestive that there may be something inflammatory or infectious going on. And this was actually the dog that I showed you the ultrasound of earlier on. This is a dog who had a stone sitting in the proximal ureter, consistent with an obstruction at that level. And actually, you could see that radiographically as well. There's a little stone just sitting up here, just behind that kidney. And those things together, with the systemic symptoms, is consistent with this thing called obstructive pyonephrosis. So it's a stone obstruction. And that typically occurs either when we get an obstructive stone that then becomes infected, or we have an infection and that induces a stone to form. It can happen both of those ways, but those dogs can develop essentially sepsis as a result of that. And so we need to think then about how we manage that stone disease. And there's two aspects any time that we see dogs with stone-related diseases. There's the acute treatment side of things, and then there's the treatment that aims to prevent the recurrence. From an acute treatment, that is typically either removal or bypass. From a prevention point of view, it's usually evaluation of underlying diseases, looking at dietary manipulation, and looking at the lifestyle side of things. So, from an acute treatment point of view, it's often things like traditional surgery for urolithiasis, so cystotomy or urethrotomies. We don't do a lot of nephrotomies. We try and avoid those because they're a bit of a nightmare. Maybe things like voiding hydropulsion if necessary. And then increasingly, there's kind of minimally invasive options for removal. So things like PCCL or PCNL, which are essentially camera access directly into the bladder or into the kidney. It's maybe things such as cystoscopy, plus or minus lithotripsy, and maybe things like extracorporeal shockwave lithotripsy, all of which are kind of possible from a minimally invasive point of view. Or, as I said before, sometimes we're looking at bypass, so use of urethral catheters, cystostomy tubes, things like urethral stents or urethral bypass, for example, and all of those are things that we may consider. In this dog, being a dog, we would favour always the use of urethral stents in dogs. They're very well tolerated and they tend to do a good job. So this dog had a urethral stent placed, remained in place for about 3 months, and we treated the infection during that time as well. The stone dissolved because it was probably a struvite stone that had formed because of the infection, and the stent then could be removed, and that dog then has gone back to being normal from there. So we can then follow that up longer term. In terms of prevention, if it's something that you're into in a big way, there's a couple of places that are very useful at looking at for prevention of urolithiasis. There's a very comprehensive consensus statement that appeared now just a couple of years ago that covers a lot of the stones that we may see and the management strategies that we may employ. There's also very good guidance that you can get from the Minnesota Urolith Center, who analyze a lot of these stones for us. The general suggestions that is less stone specific is obviously we need to think about potential for underlying disease. We need to make sure these aren't dogs who have a portosystemic shunt if they have a urate stone, for example. We need to make sure that we pick up and we treat any infection. So that's particularly relevant, obviously, for struvite stones. And it's really critical in those patients where we think they've got stones that we try and get cultures early on to guide our antibiotic therapy. If we do have a specific dietary intervention that we may be able to make, then obviously we can make that. Things like calcium restricted diets, for example, in our patients who get calcium oxalate urolithes. And then, probably most importantly, we need to try and get these dogs to have very dilute urine. And this is, I think, one of the areas that often we're not very good at following up. We should aim that any dog who's had a history of urolithiasis, we try to get their urine specific gravity consistently more dilute than 1.020, so 1020, and that should reduce the risk of saturation of the urine. The most effective way to do that is through high moisture diets, so wet diets. And I feel that there's something largely counterintuitive about the use of dry urinary diets. The way that most of those work is they have salt in them to try and make dogs drink more when they're on them. But the evidence that we have suggests that high moisture diets are more effective than high salt diets at being able to do that. So I think our first choice is always for these dogs to go on to wet urinary type diets as a general, in general terms, and then for us to monitor the urine very closely so that we make sure that it is persistently very dilute. And if it's not, we add more water, for example. And if we get particularly keen owners, often we can set them up with a refractometer at home so that they can monitor the urine and make sure that that's happening. The biggest reason that I see failures of long-term medical management of dogs who are on stone prevention is by the time they come to see us, we look at their urine and it's still very concentrated. And I think that's the bit that we often then need to address. It's not always completely straightforward to do so, but where we can, that's certainly what we should aim for. So I think that was a bit of a whistle-stop tour through urinary tract diseases. Hopefully, a few kind of useful tips, tricks, things that we might need to think about, and then a few cases that look at how we can apply those to our patients. Happy to take questions on any of those areas, really, or any other more broad urinary tract disease areas that you'd like a little bit more of a discussion on. It doesn't look to me like we have any questions at the moment, but say if there are any burning questions, then let us know.
Thanks, Andrew. There aren't any questions at the moment, but obviously, if anybody does want to get in touch, they can email me, and I can obviously forward them on to you. But on
Perfect.
behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Andrew for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.